As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome to the Athletic Fantasy Baseball Podcast. It is Thursday, April 22nd. Derek Van Riper here with a guest from RotoWire, from Masters Ball, and from ESPN Fantasy. You also hear his voice on SiriusXM, both on the Fantasy Channel as part of RotoWire's rotation of hosts and on MLB Network Radio, along with Clay Link on Saturdays in the 7 to 8 p.m. Eastern window, I believe, is when that show runs. It's Todd Zola. How's it going, Todd?
Hey, DVR, doing well. Yeah, the Saturday show, I think they time it around whenever games they broadcast. So it kind of moves around every week. We need to check it and tweet out the right time, 4 to 5, 5 to 6, depending upon the games.
There you go. All right, at Todd Zola on Twitter to follow him for all of his musings and to keep up on that schedule, which it's really cool to have a fantasy presence on a league channel. It's something that we did not have back in the day when I worked at RotoWire. I worked there for 13 years, but originally SiriusXM or Sirius Home Plate or XM Home Plate, I forget the actual branding, but the Home Plate channel was the main baseball channel years ago. That was the old Jeff Erickson show. Like the original show that the RotoWire guys were working on was all the way back on that channel before it was the league channel.
Yeah, Jeff was on for baseball. John Hansen did football. And eventually, it was a 10-year anniversary. So around 10 years ago, the fantasy channel started. So that was fun. I was sort of Jeff's. He knew he could call me at any time to get me on as a guest when the other guest canceled pinch hitter for Mr. Erickson there. Actually, the first year, Jeff was the analyst. It was a guy out of Baltimore. I think the last name, Phil Wood, maybe, was the host. And Jeff was the analyst. And Jeff took over the following year as the lead. It was kind of cool. It was weird because they would replay it. So back in the day, that was the year I was going to the gym, actually. So I'd do the interview in the morning, and I'd get in the car and hear the replay of it like at 3 in the afternoon. It's like, whoa, that's me. So anyway.
Yeah, that was before podcasts were really thing for most of us. I mean, maybe there were some really early adopters back then, but hearing yourself was actually pretty difficult to do 10-plus years
still
ago.
Still is.
There's a lot of stuff I want to talk to you about because we're in the fun but challenging part of the early season where we want everything to mean something. We want to make moves. We want to make pickups. We want to make trades. And we want to use all the toys in the box, right? We want to use StatCast data. We want to use all the information we have and try and discern some sort of meaning as we look at making moves. And I know we spoke late last season about how to handle 2020 with respect to projections. And there were a lot of unknowns at that time about what the early part of this season was going to look like, right? Well, we spoke last September. We didn't know if spring training was going to start on time. We didn't know if we were going to have a 162-game season at that point. You know, vaccines and all the things that have got us to where we are right now, like that was all still sort of up in the air last time we spoke on this show. What did you end up deciding to do as you factored 2020 into your 2021 projections?
All right, so it seems like so long ago at this point. Yeah, I made some mathematical adjustments, kind of nerdy, accounting for the geographical schedule. I ran some numbers to try to figure out how easy it was for the Central Division teams, if you will, and the requisite adjustments to as if their numbers, as if they faced the rest of the league, what their numbers would have been. So when you roll that into the baseline of projections, it's you're back on an even keel. So that was a lot of, I don't know, hand waving, but it's difficult to do because it's not as easy as looking at the WOBAs or OPS or whatever you want to use and going top to bottom, because there's literally three different leagues last year, right? I mean, there were some trades within the leagues, if you will, but they were three different leagues. So you can't take the AAA OPSs and rank them with the major league OPSs and say this team's better than that team because different leagues. And even though it's major leagues, it's the same idea. So it was a little difficult, but we did that. Similarly, it went well. I think we all thought there'd be a DH. So originally it was adjusting the NL pitchers from 18 and 19 as if they faced a DH, again, to have the baseline the same. Turned out that wasn't the case. They had to rake the adjustment back, and the adjustment back was having the 2020 pitcher numbers from the NL as if they didn't face a DH. So this is all just to get normalization. And then it was just trying to figure out playing time, trying to figure out pitching, innings, et cetera, and reevaluate how to distribute saves. But it was a couple of nerdy, just to get the baselines for pitching on the same keel as the whatever the DH was going to be.
Yeah, so it was a mess to...
it was that. I could have saved a lot. I just said it was a mess.
But the main reason I wanted to kind of step back and ask that question and start thinking about the 60-game season a little bit is that we're dealing with a sample to begin the season right now. We've got less than a third of a 60-game season in the book so far. And despite that, the sky is falling and some players have taken these massive steps forward and we're trying to make these declarative statements about what's going to happen going forward. Again, because we want all these things to mean something. Now, I think the big issue you've taken in the past, and this also came up last time we spoke, is the misapplication of stability points. We look at stats and at various points, they stabilize. And in the past, I know I was among the people that thought that meant that the player more or less owned that skill going forward. So, you know, if we're at the point where a hitter's strikeout rate had stabilized and it had been previously 30%, but it dropped down to 20% over the stabilized sample, my belief was that the new skill, the current skill going forward, was a hitter with a 20% strikeout rate. And that is wrong. That is a misapplication of what a stabilization point is. Can you walk us through how we got it wrong and how we should actually utilize stabilization points?
By we, I'm going to say I too, because I was exactly where you were before I read that the gentleman, Russell Carlton, who I could have invented stability points, has pointed out that we're all doing it wrong. And to correct just a little bit too, now to do the math, what I would do is at the 30 and the 20, the stability point is supposed to be when the point when within the data is half luck. So I call it, I'd average it and make it 25. But even so, that's wrong. The, you know, again, AKA formerly known as Pizza Cutter, now Russell Carlton, and all this stuff's on the web. The same place that people got this information, they can now get the fact that it's wrong. But for whatever reason, it's taking a lot longer for people to understand that or believe it. Because I think I wanted to believe that I was cutting edge and this 25% regressing it was beautiful. And we could use 60 plate appearances for strikeout rate and get a new baseline. But unfortunately, we can't. In short, the luck to skill ratio within those 60 plate appearances is 50%. It does not mean that the next 60 plate appearances it's going to be the same. It's just within that singular sample, it was 50% luck, 50% skill. And I thought and what I assumed was, okay, the next 60 are going to be the same and the next 60. That is not the case, unfortunately. Now, the one thing we can say is, and Mr. Carlton said so much in the piece that he kind of refuted what was going on, the points that the skills that have short and actually the word stabilization is kind of misleading. Just you call it stabilization because it's even within that sample, it's not stabilized. It's still 50-50. But so stabilization is kind of a misleading term to begin with. But anyway, those that have these shorter stabilization points probably do actually truly stabilize faster. But the point being, we just don't know exactly when, because I've been looking and I haven't found the study that said, okay, we got it wrong. This is right. I haven't found, is it 300, 350? I don't know. I'm making up numbers, but I just strikeout stabilize faster than walk, stabilize faster than going on down the line. We just don't know that the actual endpoint of when you could actually call it stabilization.
So I think this is a reason why early season player analysis is so difficult. I think it could be difficult for someone like Jazz Chisholm, who's off to a great start, right? He's showing power, he's stealing bases, he's walking a little bit, and he's striking out a lot, but that was sort of expected based on his profile and what he did in the upper levels of the minor leagues. I think it's even more difficult when we're talking about a player like Akil Baddoo, because we're talking about a Rule 5 pick who last played at High A that season, was cut short by an elbow injury, so we don't even have a full season of High A for him. And of course, he then doesn't play in the minors in 2020 because no one did. Skips over Double A and Triple A, comes up and starts hitting for power right away. And maybe we're seeing that correction already. Maybe it's easy to see that Baddoo striking out 38% of the time is, you know, a good first week story, but is really a Rule 5 pick and a guy that the Tigers are going to have to bring along very carefully. I don't necessarily want to dig into Baddoo much because I think that's a little easier to figure out with the big gap and how they got him and all that. But with Jazz Chisholm or with any player like this, where we have a more complete picture, a more normal picture of player development because it wasn't a completely lost 2020, when do you start to dig into that profile and say, okay, I believe this is real? Are there certain aspects of what he's doing that you will believe in sooner than others?
Well, I do believe in the strikeout rate, et cetera, sooner. It's just, it's just so cool to say after 60 plate appearances or 40 plate appearances, it's like 3 weeks. We just have to calm it down. So I always look at those and I still do rest of season projections and regress strikeout rate faster than the others. It's not as, not as stringent as I just kind of make up my endpoints and who knows if they're right, but again, you know, it doesn't sound very scientific and it's really not, but for someone like Chisholm, it's all about the adjustments. It's all about the league adjusting to him and him adjusting back to the league. I can't do this on everybody, but if I'm asked on Chisholm or I have Chisholm on a team, I'll look at, is it heat that's getting him beat? Is it breaking stuff that's getting him beat? Is he making adjustments to one or the other? Is he getting beat on high stuff? So I try to find out what it is that's getting beat because teams are already doing this. And that's why they're, you know, like trying to local example, Michael Chavez just couldn't lay off a high fastball and teams are just continually beating him on the high fastball. And until he made an adjustment, I was staying away from him. Then he kept getting beat by sweeping sliders. So, and this is why he's now on the alternate site. Teams kept adjusting. So let's see what happens with Chisholm. I don't know. I haven't done the deep dive yet to be able to tell you that he's getting beat on sliders or whatever it might be. So the tough players are the ones that are just getting beat on everything. But you hope you find something that you can narrow it down. And all right, let's see how he does against this. All right, well, he's getting beat by fastballs. This pitcher is a good fastball pitcher. I can use him tonight in DFS or in Otno or whatever you have as a daily league, something like that. But I don't know that there's an actual date. It's just an ongoing process. And it's kind of a player by player, a feel thing with each individual metric, how it's, I just don't get so granular as to put it in my calculator and come up with a new projection. It's kind of just a feel thing.
Yeah. And I think that's something that drives a lot of us a little bit crazy. Like we want it to be perfectly scientific. We want the numbers to steer us to the answer. But the unfortunate reality, and I think this will be true for as long as you and I are playing this game, is you will have to make some decisions without the benefit of numbers that are statistically locked in. Like you are just going to have to take some leaps sometimes based on what you see watching games, what you see in how teams are treating a player, whether it's the way opposing teams are treating him or even the way his own team is treating him with the role of playing time and where they're hitting in the order and different matchups they trust the player in and matchups they don't. I mean, I think it kind of, in a weird way, I've said this on a few other podcasts at various points. I believe in the draft skills, not roles mantra as a foundational starting point, right? Like if you're choosing between two players, draft the guy with the better skills. That's the way to go. But you do need to account for role. You do need to take in those different factors. I think that is a bigger part of a player's value over the course of a season than we probably want it to be.
Yeah, well, yes. And we'll just to adjust the point about one in the numbers. And with the StatCast data, we now think it's a false security blanket. We think we now have the data to answer our questions. Sorry, friends, we don't. But as far as the draft skills, to me, it's draft skills, not role. But draft enough players that you have choices. And in season, it's start the guys with the roles, right?
Yeah.
I think you need to draft the skills. But in season, you obviously you play the players that are playing. And is there some you have to when you do your draft? You have to give yourself enough players to choose, therefore they have to be playing. But still, in season, it's all about the playing time. And those with lesser skills that aren't playing up to their capability but are getting playing time, they're eventually going to come around. But they're, now we look at the strikeout rate and look at the walk rate. It all kind of comes together. But I'm with you in the draft skills, because eventually skills will rise to the top. But as we know, especially in the mixed leagues, you can almost score your league on at bats and innings pitched. And the leaders in those and not so much innings pitched, but at bats. And the leader in at bats usually is the leader in hitting points and rotisserie scoring.
You hinted at this a little bit. At least I think this is what you were driving at. You wrote a piece recently looking at max exit velocity, and it really doesn't correlate well to anything. And the conclusion, not to turn your piece into a one-liner, is that it's almost meaningless, which we want it to mean something, because hitting the ball really hard is fun. Like we were in the seats in the Fall League for the Fall Stars game when Vlad Jr. hit a line drive 118 miles an hour or something ridiculous. It was the hardest hit ball I think I've ever seen in a live game before. But just bring it back to Jazz Chisholm as an example, right? We look at his max exit velo and we say, 111.7, that's pretty good. That's a 76th out of over 500 guys who've hit a ball this year. Okay, that's pretty good. Power looks legit. And the barrel rate's at 14%. And I'm not pulling barrel rate into the max exit velo argument. Right. I'm just kind of thinking about how we look at players right now. It's better to have good markers in those areas than to not, but it's not as meaningful, especially this early, as we would like it to be. Again, referring more to barrel rate than average exit or max exit velocity. Were you surprised to find that max exit velocity correlated so poorly to the things that actually matter?
I don't know if I was surprised. That was what I wasn't sure about, because you can make up a narrative either way. But once I ran the numbers, it was very easy to understand why. And I wanted to kind of take a little bit of a step back. I've kind of been a component exit velocity, ground ball, fly ball, and line drive. It's kind of my thing, if you will, the past year or so, in that you can't just look at average exit velocity, especially now with the elevated swings. The relationship between ground ball, fly ball, and line drive exit velocity isn't consistent within players. The plane of their swing, the difference between the three is huge. And an uppercut swing will have a higher exit velocity on fly balls, and more of a level swing will have a higher exit velocity on ground balls, and et cetera. So the thing that sort of got me to it is we're seeing it on TV. We're seeing it at max exit velocity. We're also seeing it with our colleagues on Twitter, and they're using it as an argument that a player is good. And I didn't know. I wanted to find out. So that's when I ran the correlations and found it doesn't correlate to BABIP. It doesn't correlate to power. It barely correlates to exit velocity. So it's cool. It's fun to talk about on TV. It's sexy, but it's not predictive. And I think that's, you know, people are looking for more predictive things, and it just isn't. And we just have to accept that. And yeah, on a broadcast, if you want to, if someone wants to say it, I mean, I guess that's fine. That just trickles down and people think it means something, but it just plain doesn't. And now it does make sense, because I mean, it makes sense why it doesn't mean a whole lot. Because first of all, exit velocity on ground balls is barely correlated to the BABIP on ground balls. Exit velocity on fly balls is actually slightly negatively correlated. In other words, a shorter fly ball has a better chance of being hit, but it's pretty close to random. And line drives, it is random. It's just where you hit the ball as opposed to how hard you hit it on a line drive. So even exit velocity itself is much more important on power. Average exit velocity on fly balls is where it's at. That correlates to power. So even looking at exit velocity itself, you go to the StatCast, and I'm guilty of this, writing a million profiles in the offseason, go to the StatCast page, see a lot of red, and the guy has a low batting average. You say, well, he was unlucky. Look, he hit the ball really hard. It's going to come back. Well, not necessarily, because it doesn't correlate very well. Power, yes, but batting average, no. And it's just another example of wanting to use the newfangled data to our advantage. And there are things one can use, but we can't make it up just because we want it. You can't make it up. Yeah, if you're going to use a stat, make sure you understand it before you go out and pretend it means something.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
You know, brought up a point a couple weeks ago on rates and barrels that I thought might be a better application of barrels and max exit velos. He said, maybe we should think of barrels and barrel rate as game power. If we're thinking about scouting grades, right? You see scouting grades at Fangraphs in different places. And we should think of max exit velo maybe as more of the raw power grade. Like, you can hit a ball really hard, but if you don't make contact consistently, it doesn't really matter that much, right? If you have a 30 grade hit tool and 70 power, well, you're probably going to strike out 35% of the time. And if you find enough playing time, you would hit 25 home runs over the course of the season, but you're not going to do much else, right? Like, that to me at least seemed like a more reasonable way of setting expectations, instead of saying, well, max exit velo is going to drive us to all these sleepers. We're going to find tons of value. We're going to sort that leaderboard, you know, on April 22nd and go, hey, Andrew Young for the Diamondbacks is ninth in max exit velo this season. Therefore, Andrew Young is probably underrated and must be picked up in all leagues, right? I mean, I think some people actually want to use it that way, and it's way, way too aggressive.
Yeah, well, going back to Eno's point, I'm not even sure. I hate to say I don't agree with Eno, because that's usually not a good idea to not agree with Eno. But I don't know that I agree with Eno, just because he's using it for maximum power. A lot of people have a maximum exit velocity on ground balls or hit ground balls really hard just due to their swing. And if they did it on a pitch that's flatter, and you have a flatter swing on a flatter pitch, then you're going to have a higher exit velocity. I don't know that it portends to power. I don't think you can make that leap. But in our colleague James Anderson, my colleague at RotoWire, your friend and, you know, former colleague at RotoWire when you were with us, we talked about this on the radio, and he says, you know, when I go to watch a minor league game, are you telling me if some guy has a, you know, 115-mile average exit velocity, I should just ignore it? So I'm like, well, no, it kind of got me that I think, and I think maybe Eno is, and you're kind of implying this as well. You got to be a pretty good hitter to hit a ball that hard. Mm-hmm. So to me, it I don't know that. I think what it does is it says, look at this guy deeper.
Right.
You know, put this guy under the mic. This guy hit a ball this hard. He's going to be really good. Now put him under the microscope and see what else is there. If he's a line drive ground ball hitter at the launch angle, you know, single digit or 10 or 11 average launch angle, well, he's not going to have a lot of power. The exit velocity is coming from the ground balls and the line drives, et cetera. Maybe it does translate a little bit to batting average, but not necessarily power. But yeah, so the guys with the high exit velocities, even early in the season, the major leaguers, I think they just deserve a bigger, deeper dive to find out what you find out.
So you are more likely, going to sum this part up, to take the fly ball line drive column on average exit velocity on the StatCast leaderboard, maybe sort by that and start digging in, looking for some players that stand out to you as surprises.
Yes. Yes, both ways. And I mean, I'm trying to think. I wish I could think of more examples in Boston players, but at the top of my head, and at the time, he wasn't a Boston player. But Hunter Renfroe is an example of somebody whose average exit velocity is just, it's good. I mean, it's fine, but he's got such an uppercut swing. His average exit velocity on fly balls is upper percentile, 80th, 90th, something really high. So if you just sort and look for power and average exit velocity, it doesn't stand out. But when you sort average fly ball exit velocity, it does stand out. Now, these are all available on StatCast. I mean, you know, behind the fourth wall, I have a source that I can get it a little easier than trying to figure out how to do the leaderboards on StatCast. But that's neither here nor there. But you can get it off the StatCast with a little bit of clever filtering, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can get all this information. But yeah, for sure, I'm much more into the fly ball average exit of all the components, the fly ball average exit velocity to me is where it's at.
I just thought of this example from spring training. There was a Fangraphs piece, just a short little write-up. It was a good write-up about Brendan Rodgers smoking a ground ball. And they weren't trying to say that it meant something. They were just kind of pointing it out as that sort of oddity that you described where a hitter's swing, you know, could be such that he doesn't hit the ball in the air enough to get to the power all the time, but kind of flashes the high exit velos that you want to see. And one example of that over longer windows, maybe two examples, would be Eric Hosmer earlier in his career, just hitting worm burner after worm burner. Like, he was an extreme ground baller, but he'd hit the ball pretty hard. And I think Ryan Zimmerman, 4 or so years ago, before Daniel Murphy got in his ear a little bit and Kevin Long got in his ear and had him start lifting the ball a little bit more, he had the same kind of problem where it was pretty good exit velo, but it was just hitting the ball on the ground way too much. So it's still an ingredient. It's still a thing that you can do well, but if you don't do other things well with it, it's just not going to get you that far.
Yeah, and not to open up Pandora's box about another topic, but you can defense ground balls, right? Especially a lefty. You mentioned Eric Hosmer. Second baseman just forgets shift, just plays deeper into the outfield, increases his range and throws him out. So yeah, it's really a hard hit ground ball has a better chance to get through. But in today's defensive setups, well, there's more players there. And, you know, again, an argument for another time or a discussion for another time. But that's one reason why hard hit ground balls aren't always a good thing, is because it doesn't matter how hard it's hit, if you can defense it properly. So it's just, you know, one of those things, unfortunately. But, you know, your guy, Victor Robles, you know, you're going to look at his – I say your guy. No, it's not so much your guy. I won't go that far. Let's put words in your mouth. But where the whole industry is saying – and I said it too. My strategy is not to draft Victor Robles. It wasn't so much against Victor Robles. It was because I didn't want to be forced to draft a steals guy. You know, so it could have been anybody at the time. It just happened to be he was kind of the pet of that. But, you know, it just – you can't look at his – StatCast levers and say he's been unlucky, because you combine the speed with the soft hit ground balls and now you've got something. And we talked about this, and I think people know this at this point, but they kind of didn't realize it to begin with. But depending upon where you're looking, a guy who bunts a lot, those bunts get rolled into the average exit velocity. Mm-hmm. And I haven't seen a whole lot of bunts with a high exit velocity. So it's one of those things that, again, to use the data, you really kind of need to understand it, especially because we're, as an analyst, we're talking to people who trust us and aren't going to dig in themselves. They're just trusting us. What we say is correct. They're assuming we've done the research. They're assuming we know what we're talking about. And like I said, talking about the other thing, sometimes I was not above being wrong with the stabilization points, and I try to make sure I'm right, but maybe someone will prove me wrong in exit velocity doing a different study, and I'll be not bold enough, but I'll swallow my pride and say you're right, kind of like I would in stabilization. I hope somebody proves I'm wrong, and because it would be real nice if we could have some of this data to use as analytical points in short samples.
I was hoping that taking the bunts out for Robles was going to help my argument when I talked about him at PitchCon last year, and it didn't help. It didn't make enough of a dent in the exit velo for me to say it's just the bunting. But I think Robles is a great example at the other end of the leaderboard of a player who's been dismissed for reasons that we should not dismiss a player for. At least that is my opinion. That is my belief. And the proof for me was in the results. Like I kind of got to the point where I was like, I like StatCast, but if you're going to give me a player who hits in the bottom third of the order and he still finds a way to hit 17 home runs and steals 28 bases, it can be blue ink all over the StatCast page, and you can tell me that's an indicator that 17 and 28 might not happen again, but you can't tell me he's a horrible player with those results just because the way he did it with new ways to measure players is not visually appealing. Like, I understand those concerns. I think those are valid concerns. I think they probably limit the long-term ceiling. I mean, at one point, Acuna versus Victor Robles was an actual argument in prospect circles. Seeing how that one has played out, maybe it was obvious to people who really know prospects that it was Acuna all along, but just the fact that they were even next to each other on some lists at one point, or even side by side in a debate, we're talking about a guy that does have a lot of talent and was young for the level everywhere he played, young when he arrived in the big leagues, had an injury, I think, in 2018 that kept him from getting more time with the Nats then. So I just think for me, it's like, if I'm not going to dismiss a player with horrible StatCast numbers, I can't automatically go all in on a player with great StatCast numbers.
Right. And I think the other thing, and maybe people out there, ready to call me out on this because, looking to be wrong, looking at average exit velocity on ground balls, you can't throw every single player into that same soup. It's different for fast players and it's different for slow players, right? It doesn't matter Jesus Aguiar hits a ground ball slow, he's going to get thrown out, right? Victor Robles hits a ground ball slow, he's going to beat it out. And if they both hit it hard, it depends on how their defense. So I think the next level, if I'm going to look at component average exit velocities, now I have to look at it on different players, or different types of players, especially with ground balls. Because I think you find if we were to segregate players into different classifications, the average exit velocity on ground balls would matter. It would be a huge correlation for BABIP on certain, in whether it be sprint speed, however you want to classify the players. I think there'd be a lot more good things going on there. And intuitively, that's what's going to help Robles. If you put his average exit velocity on ground balls in a group of fast players, it may be inversely proportional that the slower the ground ball, the better, because better chance of beating it out. But I think then we'd find a higher correlation. There's just only so many hours in a day, and I can't yet afford a research staff. But I do think that's one thing about Robles and other players of that ilk. You can't even. Just ground ball exit velocity isn't enough. You need to go to the next level, and probably the next level after that.
Thinking about the average exit velocity on flies and liners for a moment, when does that start to get your attention? Because if you look at qualified hitters, of course, you're always going to miss some guys that have barely played. I'm always tempted to lower the playing time threshold with the batted ball advance to an absolute minimum, just because I want to know, who even in a little bit of playing time is doing something interesting. I kind of want those prompts to take the deeper dive. I don't want to just pull it up and go, yeah, Tyrone Taylor, picking him up. But you got to think about who the player is, how is he going to play, what else is in the profile. But to see him, you know, high up on that leaderboard, okay, that's pretty interesting. And I've seen him pop on some StatCast leaderboards in very small samples in the past. Andrew Young, who I mentioned earlier, right? It's only three batted ball events. So I know that's not enough to make an actual decision. But when do we have enough batted ball events to start to feel pretty confident in what we're seeing from a fly ball and line drive exit velocity perspective?
So yeah, it's kind of, I don't say a two-part answer here, but when I do the studies to figure out correlations, I don't know the exact number, but it's a decent number of batted ball events before I can say this correlates, that doesn't correlate. But, and this goes back to the stabilization points and as well, it's all about probability. And you want the decision to have a greater than 50% probability of being correct, or, you know, significant, that's not even these words significantly, but you want it to be greater than 50%. You know, you don't want it to be a completely random decision. And that's when the small samples come into play is, all right, Tyrone Taylor, it's only been three fly balls, but they've all been hit with a certain exit velocity. Well, I don't know. Maybe there's a better than 50% chance because it's been only been three, but yet they've all been so hard that he is going to be a guy who's going to display power or, you know, if he even back in the going back to the strikeout rate, you know, okay, so it's only three or four weeks into the season. He is striking out less. All right. I guess the probability is that maybe he has improved his contact. I just don't think we can put the number on it like we were trying to do before and then compare, you know, this. The problem is when you put numbers on two different people and now you compare those two different people, I don't think we can go that far. But I think when you look at an individual basis, you need to look at the short sample and say, well, you know what? Maybe there's a better than 50% chance that this new skill is real and make your decisions accordingly. I think we were just getting too quantitative with some of this stuff. And even you know, with the exit velocity we're talking about, I think we can get too quantitative. We still have to keep it qualitative and therefore use other means of analysis to kind of make it to get the big picture.
I know it's been a while since you've seen a movie in a theater. It's something we've joked about over the years on podcasts we've hosted together.
Well, you can say that about anybody now, right?
On radio. Well, yeah, I mean, for a lot of people, it's been more than a year, right? But it's, I know the last movie at the time we've talked about it last, the last movie you'd seen in the theater was Tommy Boy. I assume that has not changed.
That has not changed.
So I think if you remember in Tommy Boy, there's the scene with the guarantee on the box for the brake pads.
Yeah.
And Tommy, you know, says, if you want me to take a dump in a box and mark it guaranteed, I will. I've got spare time. A little crude, but relevant here because I do think that whole scene just drives the idea that the guy that wants the guarantee on the box says his customers need that, calling out to him, telling him that everything's going to be okay. I think that's sort of how we use very small amounts of data. I think we try and use that as a justification and a security blanket for the leaps that we're taking in our analysis. I think that's pretty consistent across the industry. I think we're generally all trying to do that in our own ways.
No, you're right. And I think part of it is, well, it's not, you know, I mean, the old process over outcomes, in our heads, we can sleep at night saying the process was right. And I think we're saying maybe the process wasn't as right as we thought it was. So, and unfortunately, the answer might be there is no right process, in which case we can go to sleep now saying, well, there is no right process. You know, I guess I have to be luckier, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But you can't rely on something that's not there. And it's tough because, like you say, we want it to be there. We want to be confident in our decisions. And sometimes there's just nothing there to hang your hat on.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is meme mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
So I wanted to ask you a question that I'm probably going to ask everybody I talk to for the next few weeks. It's early enough where it's still a fun question because we all would change something or a couple of somethings about our drafts if we had a little more information or a little more time or got another little peek at some players. So if I gave you two draft season mulligans and said you could use one on a hitter and one on a pitcher that you would approach differently. And we'll just say like these guys got to be healthy. It's not, oh, I don't want this guy because he got hurt, right? Tatis because he got hurt, a mulligan right, him. Right. That's not interesting, right? Like he's just hurt. It's not his fault. Who would your mulligans be based on what has happened so far or things you've learned through these first few weeks?
All right. So the first one, a go pitcher, and I'll say Brad Keller. And I know he's not a star, but the way I built my staff was I waited on pitching, figuring some guys like Brad Keller would take the next step. And he thus far hasn't. And I tweeted this out the other day as well, is that he's going to be the guy where when he's on your bench, he goes out and throws five innings against the Angels and almost shuts him out. And then when you put him in the lineup the next week, because he's got a weaker Tampa offense, they crush him. So he's always going to be on your bench when he does well and in your lineup when he gets crushed. I had him in my lineup the whole time, and that's one of the things is I'm kind of aggressive in that I don't want to miss the good stuff to equal or to balance the bad stuff. I just don't think Keller has earned that right. I should bench him until he proves he's fine because I don't know there's going to be enough good stuff to balance the bad stuff. I get too much bad stuff in him in a hole. So I think he's kind of a double whammy to me just because I trusted him and now I trust him too much not to take him out. It's just one of those things. The hitter, the first guy, one of the first guys you're asking kind of break, not so much break the rule. The mulligan I would have is I would not go into a draft saying I can wait on second baseman because I know I can draft two of the three of Colton Wong, who's hurt, so he breaks your rule, Cesar Hernandez and Jonathan Scope. I would always end up with two of those three. And maybe Hernandez bounces back. Maybe I could be too optimistic at this point in Scope. But I would pass on second baseman earlier, and I would take players out of the positions. But I would just not worry about a second baseman because I was going to get two of those three. And I was going to be fine. I'd be able to play the one with a good matchup, play the one that's hot that week. And who knows? Maybe Colton Wong comes back, and at least for three quarters of the season, I'm fine. But I think that was to pigeonhole myself into that and potentially passing up on, I don't know, Brandon Lau, other second baseman along the way that I passed on because of this. So the mulligan would be not going into a draft, just predisposed to get two of those three.
Yeah, I think that's kind of interesting just because everyone seems to have, this is how I'm speaking right now, everyone seems to have, it appears that we might think that, like, it's always conditional, it has to be because we're not really speaking in certainties. It does seem to me that people have some broader tendencies when they approach drafts and auctions, and that can lead them to miss out on players they might otherwise like. You mentioned Brandon Lau. Maybe he's a guy that you had him ranked in a spot where you were comfortable taking him in whatever, the fifth, sixth round. but because of your overarching mindset, your strategy with that position, you missed out on him. That happened to me with Corbin Burnes. And I'm talking to you wearing a Brewers hat and a Brewers hoodie, and I watch Corbin Burnes all the time. I thought Corbin Burnes was going to be good this year, and I'm sure he's going to be really good this year, and obviously he's not going to be this good all year. But the main reason, as I kind of retrace my steps, and I'm like, wait, why don't I have Burnes? Of all people, I should have too much Burnes. I'm a Brewers fan. Right. I don't have him because a lot of the time when I was drafting, that group of pitchers, for me, I had him right around, I think he was 21st on my last set of rankings. It was like Lance Lynn and Berríos and Burnes and Zach Plesac. It ended up being a group that I don't have at all because I either had two aces before then, or I had either gotten an ace early and then was still chasing some bats. And it never quite worked out with the way I wanted to get the early rounds put together for me to be in a position to take Burnes when he was the best available pitcher in my queue. I just wasn't taking a pitcher in that spot in general. And I'm really frustrated by that. I mean, clearly I had him in the wrong group. Like that the solution in this case was, well, if you had grouped Corbin Burnes with Tyler Glasnow, then you would have had a shot at getting Corbin Burnes on more of your teams. But because you ranked him too low, you missed because you ranked him in a dead spot.
Yes and no. I mean, yes, that's the answer. But it was based on data at the time. There was a reason why you had Burnes in that area. And people that took the leap of faith on Burnes and drafted him a little bit earlier, the way I look at it, and I think it's true, they're overly aggressive. I mean, they got Burnes right, but they probably got others wrong because that was their mindset. You maybe got Burnes wrong, but you probably got more players right using that same process. The thing that, you know, the whole thing with Hernandez and Wong, the second baseman in general, I know this is a mistake of mine. I know this is a huge, huge, you know, just error in my approach. And I thought I kind of fixed it in 2020. Just, you know, we didn't have a whole season to find out, but I felt more comfortable. I was really comfortable coming into the season because I was going to, I mean, I wasn't using my numbers. I was using group projections a little bit to get an overall rank for the feel of things. And I thought I had corrected a bunch of errors, but yet I convinced myself, no, you know what? I'm this one I'm right on, because looking at the second base pool, it's not very top heavy. It's very deep. This is the one exception I can make because I can't get burned. Oh, well.
I wonder if in that case, there's a common thread for the second baseman that you mentioned. It's that the real baseball, the market for those players has been underwhelming. Those are guys in the case of Scope, you know, who was non-tendered. Cesar Hernandez, who's playing on a one-year deal for $5 million. Colton Wong, also, even though he's a gold glove winning second baseman who gets on base. Like, I think you can maybe see the risk in them that comes from the way major league teams treat them, even though projections-wise, they do come out as consistently undervalued players.
Yes, you're right. But I think I think this is the reality. Because Major League downgraded them a bit, so did fantasy, and therefore they were cheap. They were available. Because in my mind, by the time drafts towards in the last week in March, Colton Wong was going 12th, 13th, 14th round. He had risen, and he still may perform. You know, you're a fan of the team. You're kind of hoping he comes back and does that sort of thing. Hernandez never caught on. Scope really never caught on. But I think fantasy-wise, it kind of followed suit. They dovetailed. And one reason I liked the strategy so much is they were available so late. They were available for so – I mean, Hernandez maybe a 20th rounder. I maybe had him as a 14th or 15th rounder. So, you know, there's the profit. And Jonathan Scope as well. So, yes, they're right now. Instead of seeing the risk, I saw the buying potential because they were so cheap. I didn't see the risk, or rationalizing the risk, and it's the market, and Cesar Hernandez is an aging veteran. It's not so much he's not good anymore, but you know they don't want to pay him because they can get somebody cheaper, and they don't care anyway. Or, you know, something you know, they don't care if he's all that good. I mean, look what the Reds are doing at shortstop. I know they put Suarez there. And since that opening game, he hasn't been terrible. But, you know, financially, teams don't want to pay for these guys, but they're actually probably pretty good. So, yeah, instead of seeing the risk, I turned it around, rationalized in my head, and I the reason they're going so late is other reasons and other than the risk, which was a mistake. Hernandez, I'm probably overly optimistic on. He's been showing signs of decline the past few years, and maybe it's my over-reliance on being able to draw a walk will eventually translate into improving numbers. I know walks don't matter for fantasy, this, you know, at least directly, unless we're in an OBP league. But for years, they did matter as far as finding players that were going to turn things around. Maybe that's not as important anymore just because of the way the game's played now.
One of the questions I had for you is more of a team analysis sort of question, but it applies to individual decisions that we have to make. When you're playing pitching matchups early in the season, and really, I guess this could apply to any point, but we're living in the early part of the season right now. What factors are you looking at? What changes your mind about teams that you're willing to comfortably throw pitchers against? This came up last night. Drew, who I think listens to the RotoWire shows and the Athletic shows, basically said, I think I would throw just about anybody against the Yankees right now. And based on what they've done so far, I understand how you reach that conclusion, right? They're hitting 205, 296, 334 as a team. They've played poorly to this point. My counterargument to that was a quick one of, you'd throw Logan Allen against the Yankees right now, down a couple ticks with his fastball last time out, right? I mean, like, the types of guys that you would actually throw out there, I don't think you go as far down with the Yankees as you might. But what matters to you this early? I mean, I guess another example could be the Padres without Tatis. Like, they're still a good lineup, but they're a little less scary when he was down with the shoulder injury. What moves the needle for you this early as it pertains to matchups for pitchers?
Yeah, things always end up in a circle, right? We're talking stabilization points. I have not done this yet. I should do this. I should have done this 20 years ago. We talk about it for players. I want to know the same thing for teams. I want to know when a team's WOBA, when a team's strikeout percent is such that you can trust that it's, you know, not real enough that you can stream it against. And I don't know the numbers, and again, I should. I keep saying I'm going to do this study, and then work gets in the way, even though this is work. So it's tough. I mean, I'm trying again. Here we go again with another Boston example. Last year, early on, and the Red Sox could not hit a lefty for the life of them. And actually, last year they didn't hit all season long. But you knew maybe this is more 2019. You knew that eventually they would. You look at all their right-handed hitters. But, you know, the numbers say play a lefty, but, you know, they're due or whatever. So you kind of look at it the same way with the Yankees now. You mentioned how poor they're hitting, but they've got a 251 batting average and balls in play. You know that team BABIP is not going to stay that low. They're not that bad. But yet their home run percent is really, really low. So, you know, you can't be that unlucky with home run per fly ball. They're just not hitting homers. So maybe I'm a little bit, maybe I do stream against them. So I do try to look at a granular level. If a team's striking out, now the Yankees are only striking out 24%. I say only 24% of the time. That seems so weird. We have to readjust our baseline. The league average is 24.5. So they're actually below average striking out. So to me, that's a scary team. I'm not going to stream a Logan Allen against the Yankees, but a good pitcher who in the past, maybe I'd bench against them. I'm not benching decent pitchers against the Yankees that I may have a few years ago, even last year, but I'm not going to stream a Logan Allen either. I mean, it's kind of, you know, it's not exactly right to say they're due and, you know, it'll be against Logan Allen, but there is a little bit of that. You know that the BABIP's going to come up. But to answer the question as far as how long into the season, I don't know. And because I'm not sure anybody knows, because I can't believe other people haven't thought of this. And if there was an answer, we both know it, you know? So, and then when you get even more granular, Logan Allen's a lefty. So how have the Yankees done against lefties? Well, you know that there's, I think it's 28%. 28% of at bats are against left-handed pitching. So you take short data And only 30% of that data is against lefty pitching anyway. So can you even judge it on that regard? So it's even different versus lefties and righties. I don't know why, you know, why we even try to do this sometimes, but we do, and that we have to. But I'll look at the strikeout rate of a team, and primarily because it's a category in fantasy, and if the pitcher can get strikeouts, normally good things will happen the rest of the game. And that's kind of my number one judge. And even strikeout rates aren't stable. There are teams, you know, right now, if we sort by strikeout rate, the Astros are always, you know, the Padres, the Mets, some of these teams are going to be striking out more as the season goes. The Royals only have a 22.5% strikeout rate. Have to believe that's going to go up a little bit over the course of the season. Although, you know, they do have an improved, well, once Mondesi comes back, of course it's going to go up. What am I saying? But it just, I will use that as the, when I'm streaming specifically, I'm more comfortable streaming against teams that strike out. At least you get strikeout points, but if you are striking out hitters, there is a better chance that the game outcome is okay.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me because the teams that are striking out the most right now, in order, the Brewers, the Rangers, the Cubs, the Tigers, the Orioles, the Mariners, and the Phillies, I want to stream against all of them with only a couple of exceptions. I don't really stream against the Phillies in Philly because the park is so hitter-friendly, so that seems pretty risky, so I don't mess around too much there. And then I always want to keep an eye, at least in daily, on what's happening at Wrigley. Got a weekly decision to make. You're probably not going to know what way the wind's going to blow at Wrigley, you know, 3, 4, 5 days from now. But I do think you can generally, you know, go at the Cubs, at least until things change a little bit there. I think sort of like the Yankees, they're going to be better than they've been so far, not to the same magnitude. The Yankees, I'm not a Yankees apologist. I'm not a Yankees fan. I said this earlier. The Yankees could lose, have losing seasons every year for 200 years, and I'd be happy about that. But that's a good team. That's the same core that year over year for the last 5 years, they've been a top five offense in terms of WRC+. They didn't age that much in a year where suddenly they're a bottom five offense. You want to tell me their new baseline is top 10 instead of top five? Okay, we can have a conversation about that. But they're not a bad team. It's just people are panicking because it's 6-11 through the first 17 games. They would care so much less if they were 6-11 for their first 17 games in July.
Oh, that's true. No, absolutely. Now, you know, look, again, so granular looking at the Cubs, we'll get, you know, the Yankees point in a sec. But so the Cubs are striking out 27% of the time, but they're also walking 10.2% of the time. And I think they've got the lowest BABIP in the league. So to me, that's a team that's just organically going to get, well, the second lowest. Indians are lower. So, you know, regression doesn't punch a time clock, but you know it's a better offense than they're showing. But, you know, the thing with the Yankees, and, you know, if you take a look at Stanton and Judge, and if everybody had hit one more home run, which in a vacuum, each individual player, it's one home run. Why not? When you do that for 8 or 9 players and now the team's hit 9 or 10 more, they're suddenly where they should be. But, you know, what are the chances that all 9 can't be one home run unlucky, et cetera. But still, they're not that far off. I mean, I'm more concerned with a Gleyber Torres, although I've been always been a bit concerned with his power, but I didn't expect to have no homers at this point of the season, than anything else. But, Logan Allen is a sit, but, you know, a mid-road, you know, Brad Keller is a sit, but, you know, Danny Duffy, I'd start. At this point, something like that.
Yeah, Duffy, I mean, he looks a little better. He's got the velo back up to where it was a few years ago, too. So that's the sort of thing I am looking at early. If a pitcher has an extra tick or even two extra ticks, has a new pitch, has changed the pitch mix, those types of things do actually matter for me really early when we're looking at some things that can change very quickly. I think pitching can change faster than hitting because of the different ways a pitcher can significantly increase or decrease his own value, right? I mean, a couple miles per hour is a big deal in either direction. And a new pitch basically means you've got a new pitcher because everything else is going to play a little bit differently.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this topic for your next guest probably because it's a great topic, but you're right. Spin rate and the spin rate on the right pitches, you know, you don't care about spin rate on a changeup, but the spin rate on the right pitchers also matters. And those can be measured. So if you had asked the question, what can you use in a short sample. My answer would have been pitchers. You can, like you're saying, you can get this variation. Now, the question always is with pitching, will it be sustained? So that's sort of the thing. Now, if a pitcher's velocity and spin rate is up now, that's what I care right now in a daily, in a daily scenario, a DFS, whatever, I care about that right now. I don't know about for the course of the season, especially with all the innings and how that's all going to work out, but it's something to keep an eye on. But sure, I make short sample decisions on pitching all the time. I'm trying to think, Anthony Desclafani a couple years ago picked up some velocity early, and he has continued to sustain it. Now I'm hoping that he can, now that he's in San Francisco, it manifests into a pitcher we all thought he would be. But yeah, for sure. And that's one of the things that got me onto Keller, was it wasn't a Lucas Giolito type change, but his spin was up and he was throwing a new pitch. And I thought the same kind of things might happen. You know, sometimes all we hear about are the changes that work out. You mentioned Eric Hosmer with the lift, Daniel Murphy. You know, some people change their swings and it doesn't work out. So some people change pitch mixes and it doesn't work out.
Yeah, and definitely easy to lose those players or to not recall them as quickly, because it's there. If you look, oh, he tried to change and couldn't command the slider, so that new slider didn't really help him all that much. Those types of things happen actually pretty often. Well, Todd, I really appreciate the time today. I think I said 40 minutes, and we've got almost a full hour here. I had a great time catching up with you. Before you go, let our listeners again know where they can find all your work.
I wish I had better answers to answer the stabilization questions, but we just don't have it. Mastersball.com remains the mothership. Still have my platinum subscription, and knock on wood, I'm working on my DFS engine, rolling that back out again. So I'm going to start doing some daily stuff with DFS on the site. RotoWire, as you mentioned, kind of work there with the podcast and doing the weekly rankings and. Behind the scenes more at this point, behind the scenes. A daily notes at ESPN is very much in front of the scenes. So writing their daily notes with, I was going to say Paul Sporter, but Paul's no longer with us. We replaced him with some guy named Derek Hardy. And then some you may have heard of. And Mike Sheets. Mike Sheets also helps me on the, helps out on the day. He's been writing daily notes longer than I have. And you were kind enough to mention Sirius. They let me on over the weekend. I do the Sunday show with Jeff Erickson. That's at 1 p.m. Eastern. That doesn't change. And you mentioned Clay. So Clay and I do the Saturday show. And check out the Twitter feed. We'll tweet out the time. If it is always 7 p.m., maybe it will be at this point. Then it's always 7. But it is kind of cool to be on the network.
Oh, yeah. It's a really cool thing. Glad you guys have that opportunity. And again, really appreciate all the time. Be sure to check out Todd's work there. Keep an eye on his Twitter feed at Todd Zola. That is going to wrap things up for this episode of the Athletic Fantasy Baseball Podcast. We are back with you with the Waiver Pod on Sunday.